Welcome to the Cold Steel Surgical Podcast with your hosts Amir Farouk and Chad Ball. We've had the absolute privilege of chatting with some amazing Canadian as well as international guests over the past year. While the topics have been broad in range, whether clinical, social, or political, our aims for the podcast continue to remain the same. We hope to inspire discussion, creativity, scholarly research, and career development in all Canadian surgeons. We hope you enjoy our second season as we continue to highlight some incredible guests, deliver detailed masterclass sessions on a myriad of clinical topics, and introduce some fresh new features such as debate and companion formats. We hope you relish the podcast as much as we do.
This week, we had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Mark Hamilton on the podcast. Dr. Hamilton is a neurosurgeon at the Foothills Medical Center in Calgary. Dr. Hamilton has helped us walk through a number of neurosurgical issues that are pertinent to general surgeons, such as hydrocephalus, the role of craniectomy in traumatic brain injuries, and DVT prophylaxis in patients with traumatic brain injuries. As always, send your comments and feedback to podcast.cjs@gmail.com.
Dr. Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We really appreciate you taking out the time to come and join us and speak with us on a really important topic that we share across our specialties. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and your training pathway?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. So I grew up in a relatively a small town in northern Ontario, north of Sudbury. Population, I think, maxed out at about 4,000. And then I went to University of Toronto for my undergraduate degree, then to McGill for medical school. And then I was actually in the armed forces for 3 years. I went through med school with a medical officer's training program, or training plan, I think they called it. I went to Ottawa for 3 years. I ended up doing 2 years of cardiology as part of my service, and then as part of the reward for my 3 years due, I got my equivalent of an R2 year of general surgery. I did my first year as a rotating intern at St. Paul's in Vancouver before I went on to Ottawa. And then I came to Calgary to do neurosurgery. I did my neurosurgery and then went to Phoenix, Arizona, to the Barrow Neurological Institute. I did a fellowship in skull base and vascular, and then stayed for an extra 6 months and did a fellowship in pediatric neurosurgery before coming back to Calgary in January 1994. Interesting transition when you move from Phoenix to Calgary in January of any year. Quite cold experience. There's an adaptation process that occurs when you're down south that was quite an adjustment. And so I started on staff working both peds and adults, but initially almost all peds, but very quickly started to develop an active adult practice in cerebral vascular and transitioned over time to the point where now I don't do pediatrics. I don't do cerebrovascular disease anymore. I do probably adult hydrocephalus, adult brain tumor in general, neurosurgical call. Come to Calgary. So I came to Calgary for my training for a couple reasons. One, my wife was doing pediatric residency in Calgary at the time. And I was in Ottawa finishing up my term in the military. And I liked the program because it had a lot of clinical experience and the people seemed very nice and I thought it would be a good experience. And it was. It was a great residency experience. And then when we went to the States, my wife was doing pediatric emergency medicine at the Children's Hospital. We went to the States to do my fellowship. And then we're looking at jobs in the U.S. and Canada, and an opportunity came up in Calgary, and that's how we ended up back in Calgary. We have, you know, like most people, You look for a place that has a good program, a place where you can do the work you want to do. And if you have family nearby, that's a bonus. And so we have family nearby, and that was a reason to come back. So that's what we did.
So interesting. Dr. Hamilton, you were obviously, as you mentioned, a primary pediatric neurosurgeon for a very long time. And we were curious, how was that? How did you like that? How did you frame that? And I wonder, do you miss it?
Yeah, I mean, I liked pediatrics, always liked pediatrics before I even went away to do my fellowship. When I was offered the opportunity to do pediatrics, it was with the assumption that I would do pediatrics and adult neurosurgery. And eventually that became a taxing venture because it was there were years when it was basically full-time pediatrics and full-time adult with not much in the middle. And it was pretty busy. But I like pediatrics, the different world. Pediatric neurosurgery is a different world. And I really enjoyed it. I eventually made the transition to a full adult practice because of the need for a transitional process in pediatrics. When I arrived in 1994, Terry Miles was the only pediatric neurosurgeon in the city, and was exhausted. So we needed to build a program that was sustainable. And having me hang on to the last minute was not going to allow that to happen. So I was willing to make that transition. And at the same time, I was also developing this interest in transitional care. And over the years, by just the way things were set up, I looked after patients that I first got involved with when they were as children, and then when they became adults, I assumed their care in my adult practice, and started to do more and more adult hydrocephalus, and then realized that there was a huge gap in the care models for this patient group. And so when I made the transition, it was knowing what I was going to be developing was something that I already had a foothold in. And do I miss pediatrics? Absolutely. It was a wonderful experience. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the people, enjoyed the families. I've sort of reached the other end of the spectrum because now my practice is predominantly geriatric. A huge part of my hydrocephalus practice has now become geriatric. So I used to see children with their families. Now I see patients with their children much more commonly.
I'm glad you brought up hydrocephalus, and maybe we can drill down on a couple of questions related to that before we talk about head injuries. I'm curious. My sense is that hydrocephalus is a diagnosis that's missed consistently and often, and both by families and primary care physicians as well as specialists. So I guess the first thing is, what sort of things do you look for, maybe as a non-neurosurgeon, in diagnosing hydrocephalus?
That's a good question. And whenever I end up talking to somebody about hydrocephalus, I step back and say, if we talk about adults with hydrocephalus, we're not talking about one disorder. And the problems and challenges vary from subtype to subtype. And a number of years ago, proposed a rather pragmatic organizational construct. It helps because each of these groups has different issues. So one group is the patients that were diagnosed as children. So they transition to an adult hospital care, clinical care environment. Those patients typically carry different issues related to their shunt management, different risks for many of them when their shunts fail. And they are, I think, at a higher percentage when their shunts fail, they get into more acute situations because some of them are extremely shunt dependent. They also have a not insignificant number of them showing up with pseudocysts in the abdomen, which you have to be aware of and look for. If they come in with shunt failure. Then there's a group that is acquired hydrocephalus. And these are the patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage, brain tumor, trauma. And they've always been around, so to speak. I think people have always sort of recognized that this occurs, but there's different strategies that exist on how people approach management. And if you look at the literature, for instance, on subarachnoid hemorrhage and shunt dependence, you'll see that it ranges from anywhere from about 5% to 50% in studies, very retrospective, often without defined protocols. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in sorting those out. Even the management of an external ventricular drain in the subarachnoid hemorrhage population with hydrocephalus, or initial hydrocephalus ventricular megaly, is not very well established. When you come to brain trauma, this same issue. So as people try and figure out, is this the brain trauma result? Is this the hydrocephalus now becoming an issue result? Are the changes on the scan related to atrophy, or are they related to progressive ventricular enlargement because they can't manage their CSF? So that's a whole group. Then the third group is this group of patients who present, and they're usually middle aged, so anywhere from, depending on what you define as middle aged, it's sort of in the 40s to early 60s. Quite the average is about 55 to 58. These are patients who have unrecognized, previously undiagnosed ventricular megaly, hydrocephalus. And they present sometimes because they're found with big ventricles, because they've had a head trauma, they had a CT for a headache problem. They get referred because of big ventricles, or they have progressive memory problems, which is a significant issue in this group. Some of these patients require intervention, and some of them require observation and longitudinal care to determine when they might get into trouble. But we have a process to sort that out. The message that we give to care providers in the emergency room is, if you have somebody with big ventricles, we'd rather see them and sort out whether this is an issue for them rather than miss them. When you miss these people, they show up in their late 60s, early 70s with quite significant, profound dementia, often not reversible by that time. And then finally, the fourth group is the INPH group, the idiopathic normal pressure hydrocephalus group. INPH is for some people, is a controversial diagnosis. That's based on old literature, old understandings. And INPH, this is the elderly patient. The definitions usually we use require age above 60. But the average age, when you look at this group, is somewhere around 75 to 77. And this group, they present with this nonspecific triad. So it's a gait disturbance, cognitive disturbance, and bladder urgency and frequency. And you know, if you put those three out there, as you know, and you talk about 75 and 80 year olds, people might say, well, you know, that could be just old age. But this is a progressive problem for these people. And they almost always have to have gait. And by gait, I mean balance and stability, slowing, shuffling of gait. And for cognitive issues, it really depends on where you intersect with the person in the time course of their disease. And bladder urgency and frequency are, people usually ask about incontinence, but usually these people have urgency and frequency. And the incontinence comes often when they just can't mobilize fast enough to get to the washroom. So it's a diagnosis that needs to be sorted out. It's often missed because it's attributed to old age. There was a interesting study done a number of years ago where they went into three nursing homes in West Virginia, and they looked at just the patients who had the symptom complex that would suggest you should at least investigate with a CT scan or and do some further investigations. 10% of the group met the basic criteria and had not been investigated. We were doing a project looking at the epidemiology of hydrocephalus with the Public Health Agency of Canada. What startled me was the number of patients who end up in nursing homes. This is across Canada and probably across North America, who never have a CT scan. They've got a diagnosis of dementia. They don't have a CT scan. They've never seen a neurologist or a neurosurgeon. They have dementia. And if you walk out into a crowd and I think you ask people, you know, who what does dementia mean to you? It would be Alzheimer's disease. So by default, these people get labeled as having Alzheimer's disease. And INPH is potentially reversible if you identify it early enough. And there are processes that we are quite comfortable with in terms of undertaking that mission. So the message basically is, if you are elderly and you've got cognitive gait issues, don't dismiss it as Alzheimer's disease. If you're middle-aged and you've got cognitive issues, don't dismiss it at all. Those patients need investigation with CT and MR. And if you are a transition patient, you need some place to look after you for the rest of your life, because when you become an adult, your problem doesn't go away.
You know, one of the things you briefly mentioned in chatting there was the EVD, and, you know, your hydrocephalus practice is obviously internationally renowned, and you're a famous guy for that reason. And I also realized that the peer-reviewed publication is not out yet, but you're doing some really interesting work with the general surgery side of things in terms of laparoscopic placement of VP shunts. Can you touch on that and sort of why that's been so helpful, particularly with regard to distal shunt obstruction and failure?
Sure, absolutely. It's when you look at hydrocephalus in general, people still think it's a pediatric problem. When you deal with kids and shunts, when shunts fail, they tend to fail proximally. So a shunt is made up of three main parts: a ventricular catheter, for VP shunts rather, a ventricular catheter, a valve, and a distal catheter that goes either into the abdomen or potentially into the superior vena cava atrial junction. So when you look at kids, it's proximal failure. When you look at adults, especially older adults, it's distal failure. And it's proximal failure occurs very infrequently. And there's lots of reasons that we go into to explain that, but just recognizing that and not doing something about it, you end up with a distal failure rate that approaches 50% at 3.5 to 4 years. And that that's local experience when I started looking at prospective data. When you look at we're doing a systematic review meta-analysis of shunt failure in adult patients. When you look at that literature, the first message from the literature is it's horrible because it's very poorly done. You end up with less than 100 papers where you can extract data. And the data suggests that there's a 15% shunt failure rate at 6 months. And that's all adults. So that's those four different disorders. Shunt failure is a common issue. One of the things we started doing, and I ended up collaborating with UChat, as you're well aware, others may not be. And we started looking at what can we do with the distal end of the catheter to avoid this complication. I was doing more shunt revisions than I was shunt insertions. So if you do longitudinal care and you put shunts in and they fail, you end up revising them, and then they'll fail again, and you keep revising them. And these operations were removing the catheter and simply putting it back in the belly. So it wasn't that they were plugged, they were in a position where they couldn't drain properly. And the traditional method of doing a shunt, the peritoneal catheter insertion for a shunt, is simply to make they call it a mini laparotomy, which is a really mini, and you end up getting access to the peritoneal cavity, and you just slide the catheter, which is coming down subcutaneously, into the peritoneal cavity. And then it just floats freely. So NPH patients, for instance, don't have high driving pressures to their shunts. Very easy to create distal back pressure and block their shunt. So there was a paper published a number of years ago called using what was called the falciform technique, it was a retrospective series of hemorrhages, 50 or 60 patients, and they used the laparoscopic approach, have the catheter come in about the level of the zippy sternum, and then make a hole in the falciform ligament and tuck it behind the liver. Then that would keep it away from the omentum and the other things that could potentially obstruct the shunt. So we started doing this. We had to learn and modify as we went along, as the instructions were and the technical issues were not very well elaborated. And we did a prospective series of consecutive patients. The shunt failure rate doing that, and also I added image guidance for passing of the ventricular catheter, which is still done in the majority of places in the world freehand, even though image guidance is available at most modern neurosurgical centers. And that combination, and most of it, the effect was from the abdomen, dropped the shunt failure rate to about 16% at 3.5 to 4 years. So a very dramatic reduction in distal catheter failure rates, very dramatic reduction in the number of secondary failure rates. And by examining the characteristics of the abdomen with the laparoscope, rather than just blindly stuffing a catheter into the abdomen, we could document whether there were a lot of adhesions, a lot of scarring, whether there was a lot of momentum up over the liver that might block the distal catheter, even if we placed it in our optimal position. With all that, I think we've learned when patients, even when you think the abdomen might work, it's just not going to work very well. And there's an alternative shunt called the VA shunt, where we've modified the techniques for insertion of that. One of the last remaining things we have to sort of struggle with is the fact that the catheters that stay behind the liver, the failure rate is extremely low. The catheters that we put behind the liver, some of them pop out very quickly. And those go on to fail at a rate that's very similar to the non-laparoscopic group. So there are things that could be further modified to improve this. But I think this is a, and this, the number of patients in this series is about 240. About half of them before laparoscopic and half of them after, all consecutive prospective patients. So it's a, I think it's a pretty large group, powerful group. It's we're just doing some revisions for the paper, and I'm hoping it will be accepted and as soon as we submit it. We're also submitting a video equivalent to Jove for review.
One of the neat things about that work is how you cross different specialties and put the brains together with different specialties to do things that we wouldn't have traditionally thought of as something that would involve both general surgery and neurosurgery. So congratulations on all that really amazing work. We wanted to leverage your expertise as well to chat a bit about head injuries with our audience being mainly general surgeons. Can you talk a bit about how to classify traumatic brain injuries for us? And let's say someone comes into the emergency department who is found to have a traumatic brain injury, who needs further assessment?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's lots of different classifications that are used. There's clinical classifications, CT classification, whether it's diffuse focal, diffuse axonal injury type of injury pattern for the patient. I mean, I think most people end up classifying from a pragmatic viewpoint. Classify head injuries as or traumatic brain injury as mild, moderate, and severe. There's different strategies for each of those groups, and you're making that assessment of the degree of severity of the head injury. Is it in the first hour, or is it in the first 6 hours? So the Glasgow-Coma scale, I think most people are familiar with. So Glasgow-Coma scale of 14, 15 out of 15 is usually going to be mild head injury. 13 and below to 9 to 13 is going to be sort of moderate, and 8 and under, some people will call severe. There's a bit of variability in how people use those terms, but that's the general sort of construct. If you have a mild head injury, and then the other thing that you have to remember is that there's all this group of people who have very mild head injuries, but to have consequences from those head injuries and they get classified as having concussional injuries. So mild head injuries by definition, usually with a normal GCS and usually with a normal CT scan. And that's how most people are assessed in emergency department, not with MR imaging, but with CT scans. So a number of years ago, about 8 or 9 years ago, we were struggling with how do you define who needs to be at a tertiary care center in Calgary. For instance, the Foothills Hospital, that's where neurosurgery is based, versus who can be kept at another center without risk of them deteriorating. We actually developed some guidelines, which I think to this day, 8 or 9 years later, still hold true. We haven't had any major issues that I'm aware of in the use of these to determine who should or shouldn't be at a center. When you're looking, this gets to be a rather large topic as you dive deep into it. But, symptom management, I think, for mild head injuries is important. Some patients may have a normal CT, but they can be very symptomatic and may require some additional help in the emergency department. The basic things that led us to divided the patients into those that we could do a phone consult with the center, give them some advice, and those that we required transfer to the Foothills Hospital. And this helps sort of organize, the severe from the moderate to severe and the mild. So, I think part of it depended on their vascular coma scale. So a mild injury, 14 or 15 for GCS, maybe had a small contusion on their CT or no contusion, small epidural hematoma, no shift, a tiny depressed fracture. Those are all sort of compatible with staying at a center. Usually they might require and may require admission, but they don't have to be sent to a tertiary center. And those patients will often just require symptom management. One of the questions that we often get asked is, so do you repeat the CT scan? And that's going to vary depending on a number of factors. And then they may require admission for 1 or 2 days for symptom management and to do a follow-up CT scan. So for that group, the one we're doing a phone consult and they may be admitted elsewhere, I think, if they're on, antiplatelet agents, in particular, Plavix, if they're on anticoagulants, particularly Doax, they may be at a higher risk for expansion of their, if they have small contusions or hemorrhage, maybe at a higher risk. There's a lot of work that's being done on trying to determine when you can not do a follow-up CT scan rather than even when you should do one or can do one. Lots of people will still do one 24 to 48 hours later. I think that there's probably future work that's going to help sort out that and parse that a bit more. I at times will make recommendations not to repeat a CT scan and go on symptoms because it's so minuscule and having a dot of hemorrhage does not validate the need to necessarily do a hemorrhage if they're not on an antiplatelet agent or an anticoagulant. If somebody's on an anticoagulant or has a slightly bigger hemorrhage or contusion, but still under that threshold, then I often would recommend they do another scan. And the patients who get transferred you're starting to look at people who have clinically a moderately severe head injury, such as the Glasgow Coma Scale less than 13 or less than equal to 13, rather. And then they've got evidence of a bigger intracerebral hemorrhage, subdural hemorrhage, epidural hemorrhage, perhaps a midline shift. If they're starting to get effacement of the basal cisterns on their CT scan, that usually means they're running out of room, and that's a higher risk issue. If they have multiple hemorrhages that are, even though they may all be small, but there's multiple ones, that's something they could consider. Compound depressed skull fractures, another category. A little depressed skull fracture, there's no indication, no required indication to elevate that. You can even, if there's a laceration, you can clean that out, wash it out, sew it up. Some centers will give a dose of ANSEF at the time they do that. But if it's a compound depressed fracture with a lot of depression, they usually should be at a tertiary care center because they may have underlying contusions or frequently do have underlying contusions. Basal skull fractures with CSF leaks should be out of center. And then patients, as I mentioned, who are on anticoagulants and significant antiplatelet agents can be an issue. And then that's basically how you end up determining who needs to be at a tertiary care center. And then that also sort of defines who's going to be most at risk potentially for getting into trouble.
You know, there's often a lot of emphasis on the management of traumatic brain injuries. And I think that's beyond the scope of what we're trying to do today. But one thing that I think is still often isn't as talked about on lots of podcasts that I've listened to and lots of resources that I've read, but that comes up quite frequently when you're in the middle of the night on the trauma service is, when do you actually need to consider a surgical decompression? And sometimes I find that my sense as a general surgery resident was often not aligned necessarily with what would happen to that patient, let's say, who came in with a traumatic brain injury. So how do you sort of think about the patient that needs a surgical decompression?
That's a good question without an easy answer. We always say it's a case-by-case basis, but there are, I think, some elements that are, that there's common elements that come into play. I think, hopefully I'll keep this organized as we're talking about it, but, I think a patient who's got massively destructive brain injury with a subdural, they've got evidence of deray hemorrhages in the brainstem. Their GCS is extremely poor. Their pupils are blown. Their brainstem reflexes are bad. They may or may not be an anticoagulant. That's a whole other complexity that adds added to this. Those patients, you really have to step back and say, are you going to offer them anything of value in terms of improving their outcome or survival? And the answer for almost all of those is no. We tend to, I think, weigh it a little differently depending on age. But at that end of the spectrum, I don't think age is going to matter. If your pupils are blown and your GCS is 3, it doesn't matter how big the hemorrhage is, surgery is not going to help you. When you get in to the middle ground where you've got somebody who's in the moderate severity head injury, with GCS 13 and under, those are patients where you're struggling a bit more with, or what we struggle a bit more with. So it's often, so what is the status of their pupils? If you have somebody who is younger, they often can't accommodate the blood volume, but they don't have the space to accommodate it. And there's this doctrine called the Monroe-Keeley doctrine that everybody learns about in neurosurgery when they start training, that there's only a few things that are in the head, in the skull, brain, blood, and CSF. And if you start adding one, the other has something else has to give. You can compensate up to a point, but then you can't manage. There's no more CSF to get out, and that's when you start getting an effect that might be herniation. Or you might have decreased cerebral blood flow in general because of high ICP, and the clinical consequences increase. So a young person, you're going to see, you might see that the basal cisterns are more effaced, and a subdural or an epidural might, even though they might be at the better end of a moderate spectrum, I might be more concerned and want to take that out. There is I must admit, a certain gestalt about the size of the subdural or the epidural that will push you one way or the other. I find it sort of makes me want to consider surgery rather than observation. And it's different for subdurals than even in epidurals. Epidurals, size is important. Location is extremely important as well. So I did a paper with one of the neuroradiologists, Carl Wallace, when I was a resident. We looked at the non-surgical management of epidural hematomas. And the only few patients in that series that deteriorated were people who shouldn't have been watched anyway. They had epidurals in the middle fossa, Those are patients that are more, you know, that gets, they're at a, there's a point where they can very quickly move to uncal herniation, blow their pupil and deteriorate. So the location of an epidural hematoma, they may not accommodate size there. Whereas if you get an occipital region epidural hematoma, you might accommodate that extremely well and it might be very capable of watching it. Acute subdural hematomas are usually associated with, you know, a more severe mechanism of injury. So these patients often, you know, it's more Gigalax, it's acceleration, deceleration. There's usually more injury going on than you see on the scan. There's diffuse injury. Autoregulation in the brain for blood flow is not probably disrupted. Those patients, especially since that population tends to be younger, you have to have a lower threshold for considering removal of the subdural in an acute situation, especially if they haven't sort of reached into that, you know, totally destructive phase. You know, intracerebral hemorrhages with trauma are not incredibly common. It's usually contusions that blossom. You do get the occasional hemorrhage, intracerebral hemorrhage with trauma, and those you just have to work on the overall exam feature size. And by size, you sort of end up looking, trying to calculate a volume and then determine whether surgery is warranted. Is it superficial? Is it deep? So all those factors come into play. You know, one of the big confounders that has come up in the past number of years has been the introduction of DOACs and even just the use of Plavix over the years. Patients who are on those agents, even though we're starting to get access to agents that can reverse the effects, those patients become extremely challenging to deal with when they present, no matter how big your hemorrhage is.
Sort of on a related note, how do you think about who needs an intracranial monitor and how do you make that decision?
So intracranial monitors, you can divide them into a number of different types. And then you can move from, and then there's the criteria, then the type. So just to make sure I don't forget the type aspect of the question. Patients with the general sort of rule of thumb, and I think it's a rule of thumb only, is that GCS 8 and below, you know, more severe head injury should have an ICP monitor. And I would put quotation marks around should. So it really depends on if you're a GCS of 3, we'll look at other factors and, that have to be dealt with before we might consider an ICP monitor. Is there any recoverability that's possible? If your GCS is 8, then ICP monitoring, might be something worthwhile, and usually is worthwhile in terms of sorting out what's happening to the patient, managing their cerebral perfusion pressure as part of that algorithm. So that becomes important for that patient group. And then above that, it becomes really, it depends on where you are. If your GCS is 12, it's very unlikely you're going to get an ICP monitor. You need one. But unless you've got something that's producing hydrocephalus and we fear that you're going to deteriorate. Not so much in trauma, but we had a gentleman who had a big basal ganglion hemorrhage, and he was in the process of rapidly deteriorating, and it was all hydro-related. So that the potential is there with trauma. You could get some interventricular blood to block your aqueduct and give you hydro, in which case their GCS is going to head there, but if the ventricles are enlarging, you have to consider that as a factor earlier on. It's not something that is universally agreed upon using GCS 8 and below, but it's a point I think you can sort of start to think about patients who hover around that, above 8, probably. You have to be a little more select, very, very selective. Below 8, you should be doing it much more often. So the type of monitor is also relevant. Excuse me. is the type of monitor is also very relevant. So there's an external ventricular drain, which is a catheter that's placed into the ventricular system that's hooked up to a closed draining system, so you can monitor ICP and remove CSF. So as I mentioned with the Monroe-Keeley doctrine, you only have three things in the brain, you know, brain, blood, and CSF. So you can potentially remove CSF so it can become a diagnostic therapeutic tool. Then there's the next most commonly used thing is the interparenchymal monitor. And it's there are different companies that have these. Codman, for instance, makes one, and it's got a transducer on the end. You just simply put it into the parenchyma 2 centimeters or so in, and it can read ICP, but it cannot provide any opportunities for therapeutics. You can't remove CSF with it. So I think that EVDs, people will approach using EVDs as having the benefit of therapeutics, but the challenge in somebody with a head injury is hitting small or normal ventricles. And our neurosurgery residents tend to do these often in the ICU. They become very good at it because of the teaching that occurs and the standard methods that we use. But these are done without image guidance. These are done by using landmarks and looking at the CT scan and aiming for the ventricles. If you look at the literature, the failure rate for hitting the ventricles is not insignificant. And the number of patients who require multiple passes of a catheter to actually tap the ventricles is not insignificant. The risk of infection from an EVD is not insignificant. It probably approaches anywhere between 5% and 15%, depending on how long the catheter's in and whether you use a standard infection reduction protocol like they would do for central lines. That's generally absent in many centers. So the infection rates are all over the place when you look at the literature. So EVDs carry a higher risk, but offer more potential benefit. I trained when I was in Calgary as a resident with a very non-interventional approach to traumatic brain injury in terms of ICP monitoring. And I actually think we should be doing ICP monitoring and we should be doing it within the parameters I outlined because I think it does give us a lot of advantage. The literature tends to support that. I think otherwise you're flying blind. When I was training, we were told to use sequential CT scans. I think that's it's like taking snapshots of a parade that's 12 miles long every 2 minutes. You're going to keep missing things. And so you miss opportunities when you use that kind of approach.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I think that makes total sense. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you in terms of intervention, maybe at the opposite end of the spectrum, was about craniectomy or leaving the bone flap off. And it was a question I had for you because certainly in traveling internationally to various places doing, the visiting prof grand rounds thing, it seems that the rate or the fervor for doing craniectomy is massively variable in neurosurgical groups from trauma center to trauma center. So I'm curious what the foundational realities of that procedure are, as well as the variability and what would explain that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And one that people have tried to answer unsuccessfully. There is incredible variability. I would agree with that. And I think there are two big clinical trials that were done. Both of them dealt with, I think it was most of them were patients were bifrontal craniectomy, decompressive craniectomies. Most of the patients were further down the road in their treatment process. So these were not decompress for an epidural or a subdural leave the bone flap off. These are patients who were being managed, their ICP got out of control, and then they went on to do a decompressive craniectomy. That was the rescue ICP trial and the DECRA trial were the two. And they answered things and they created a lot of questions. I think it even after these two randomized trials, we're left with a lot of uncertainty about the actual real benefits in terms of outcome when we do this. I think part of the controversy is, what is a good outcome? Is it survival, or are we really looking at outcome measures that really say these patients don't just survive, but they actually have a quality of life survival that makes it worthwhile to go through that. There was a very, I think, well done paper. It was in Neurosurgery in September of this year. And it was an update on the guidelines dealing with decompressive craniectomy. And they actually, at the end, put together a section where they entitled it Incorporating the Evidence into Practice. And even that was almost a page long as they tried to sort of manage the issues. They concluded that, you know, the basically performing a decompressive craniotomy is not a simple decision. And the benefits should be balanced against the complications and likely outcomes on a case-by-case basis. So after all that effort, we're still, I think, we haven't moved the dial that far forward. And there is a lot of individual center bias about the value of decompressive craniectomy. And doing the craniectomy is only one part of it. You have some patients where you do it and they will experience brain herniation right through the defect, which ends up damaging that part of the brain. That plays into the issue of survival versus quality of life and function afterwards. And then at the end of the process, you have to return that bone flap. You have to do a cranioplasty. So usually doing a decompressive craniectomy, we freeze the bone flaps. There are centers where they're doing trauma flaps. They'll put them into the abdominal wall, just buried in fat, and then take it out at the time of surgery. The major issues with returning a doing a cranioplasty, so others returning their bone flap, the major issue is infection. The second major issue is resorption. So the infection rates, when you look at the literature, are pretty significant, probably 5 to 10%. And then you start getting into what do you use to replace it if you don't use the bone flap, or if the bone flap is infected. There are pre-made cranioplasty pieces that you can model. You can get custom-made ones. And there's a growing interest and literature, a small series on people in centers that 3D print their cranioplasties to put them in. The advantage of a form-fitting custom one is that it really does make a difference in terms of the ease of the operation and the cosmetic appearance. There's a lot of literature that comes out, a lot of literature that gets submitted regarding decompressive craniectomy in terms of managing the downstream effects and turning it back or putting back the flap. And then there's also the issues that occur in the middle. There's this syndrome called the syndrome of the trephined, where they get a sunken appearance on their craniectomy side, like to the point where you can literally pour water and have it collect in the defect that happens. The brain collapses away from it. It has a number of different names, but that can be quite symptomatic in some patients. We've seen some patients who, when they get their bone flap put back, actually start to improve after that, because that may have been hurting them as well. So again, it's a very complicated issue. It needs a lot more work to sort through it. Bottom line is, I think decompressive craniectomy plays a role. I do it on case-by-case basis, but I don't know any better based on my review of the literature. Timing is important. Just all these two studies and others have not really dealt with doing a craniotomy for acute subdural hematoma, leaving the bone flap off at that time. That's just not, the literature is not really good on that. There's been no prospective trial that I'm aware of. And then So knowing when to intervene is really important if you're going to intervene. You wait too long, damage has been done. If you operate too early, you're doing it on people that don't may not need it. And then dealing with the consequences of having done that operation, you have to at some point replace the bone flap, do a cranioplasty, and manage those potential complications and the symptoms that may occur in between those two events as the patient's getting better but still suffering from the consequences of the cranium, of the decompressive craniectomy.
The last question I wanted to ask you before we part ways, and again, thank you for your time, surrounds, I think, another area that really is not so sorted out in the literature or in CPGs in general, which is the use of chemical DVT prophylaxis in patients with moderate TBIs and sometimes severe TBIs. And, you know, my anecdote, and I don't mean it to be offensive to anybody, but it often, in many of the places I've trained in and also worked, seems to be up to maybe a junior neurosurgery resident who will just sort of arbitrarily say 48 hours or 24 hours or 72 hours. And, you know, I certainly realize in having delved deep into that literature that it is all over the place. But, you know, I do wonder a little bit when I reflect on the general surgical trauma side. And we've become in the last 10 years really aggressive about chemical DVT prophylaxis. You know, I remember the days, as do you, I'm sure, when you would crack your spleen in a grade 4 injury and you'd be on bed rest and the whole rigmarole and you wouldn't get DVT prophylaxis at all. Well, now you can split your liver in half, you can split your spleen in half, and we'll generally give that post-admission day one in the morning, away we go. And you see very, very rarely any issue with that. So I was wondering if you could frame the current status and the current beliefs as best you can with regard to chemical DVT prophylaxis for TBIs.
Another good question, and it's about as well sorted out as the decompressive craniectomy issue. I'll just give you some... So this is an area that I've been interested in for a long time, and I haven't delved tremendously into the trauma literature recently, but when I look at, when I was a resident, I was interested in DVT, DVT prophylaxis, the consequences from DVT and PE, and that I didn't mention earlier on, but I was actually, before I decided to become a neurosurgeon, I was heading to become a hematologist. And that was actually an interest that carried over. When I was a resident, I did a review of DVT prophylaxis and management in neurosurgery patients across the boards, looking at trauma, looking at spinal cord injury. There are some things that have not changed a lot since that was published, and that's back in the early 90s. I did a I worked with Bill Galley as a internist and does a lot of work with clinical research. We did a meta-analysis of DVT prophylaxis, looking specifically at chemical DVT prophylaxis in elective brain craniotomy, elective brain surgery. So patients coming for tumors or elective procedures, just to try and get a clean cohort. When we finished that, it became obvious that there were a couple of things that stood out. One is that if you use chemical prophylaxis in these patients, there's an increased risk of bleeding. And that's not surprising. I mean, when you look at even the literature on aspirin for prophylaxis of, vascular events, and people have never had a vascular injury. And look at those large population studies. There's an incidence of hemorrhage that's a little higher even with aspirin in that group. When we looked at this, there, you know, we looked at complications specifically because we wanted to look at the those issues in relationship to the, also in relationship to the benefits, and try and do a risk-benefit ratio. And I think that there's when you come down to the so I think there is a risk, but there is also a real benefit. We emphasize the need for, when possible, use pneumatics, intermittent pneumatic compression. And those, I think, are effective if people actually wear them. In the ICU, that's a little easier to enforce. I've done audits in the neurosurgical ICU and found, you know, up to 30% non-compliance. And I'm sure there are days when it's even worse than that. So, they, again, as we all know, they only work if they're on the patient. And functional. There is an interesting little paper buried in an obscure journal, but it was from the Salt Lake City experience with DVT prophylaxis in nurse surgery patients, craniotomy patients undergoing craniotomies. And one of the things they identified was that low molecular weight heparins seem to have a higher risk of hemorrhage. And what the reason why that's a big issue is that the consequences, I think, as we'd all agree, with hemorrhage, intracranial hemorrhage, from the point of view of neurological function and outcome, can be quite devastating. And trying to limit that, they found that there was an increased risk of low molecular weight heparins that was not that significant a risk with low dose heparin, so unfractionated heparin. So I actually had gone through a phase where I was giving low dose heparin before elective craniotomies, and then carrying it on. It generates a fair amount of angst when you have people undergoing craniotomies who are on chemical prophylaxis at the time of their surgery. So I stopped doing that. I don't think the evidence was that overwhelming that it was beneficial. But I'm quite willing to start people on prophylaxis with unfractionated heparin very quickly, recognizing that unfractionated heparin carries the risk of a HIT, although it's not very high. But the Salt Lake City, coming back to the Salt Lake City protocol, and what I, as you try and advocate, is that we do stockings, pneumatic stockings, intermittent pneumatic compression. We start unfractionated heparin either that night or the next morning. And then at 72 hours, we'll switch into low molecular weight heparin if they are not mobile. And so if a person's mobile 4 hours a day, they don't need to go on chemical prophylaxis. Now, the trauma patients are going to be not mobile, so they're going to have to consider that. So I usually will take that approach. That said, I think you're going to find incredible variability wherever you practice regarding this particular issue, and there's not going to be a real consensus because nobody's really done the studies properly. When we did this systematic meta-analysis on elective cranial surgery, there were a couple of studies that have been done in cranial patients comparing low molecular weight heparin to unfractionated heparin. And the bleeding risks, although not statistically significant, were definitely higher. And one of the trials was actually stopped. And they were definitely higher in the low molecular weight heparin group. There was a study that was done when I was in the early 90s. I was the PI in Calgary for a spinal cord injury trial using low molecular weight heparin. It had to be stopped because of the increased risk of epidural hematomas, spinal epidural hematomas, and the neurological consequences of that. And that paper was eventually published long time after the study was stopped, but it demonstrated the risks in that acute phase. So if I had to give a recommendation, I would say pneumatics, if the patient is stable the next day, I think they can, start on unfractionated heparin within less than 24 hours, 18 to 24 hours. And then if you're going to start low molecular weight heparin, if they've had hemorrhage issues, we would usually rescan them. And then we would start them on low molecular weight heparin. The one proviso is that if they have a drain in place, an EBD, that if there's any risk that that's going to have to be removed or replaced, those agents are going to have to be stopped with sufficient time to allow any potential risk to wear off.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you've liked what you've been listening to, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your comments and feedback, so feel free to email us at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or connect with us on Twitter @CanJSurge. Thanks again.